Hey, motherfuckers, you listen to Three Ring Radio, so fuck you.
Hello, you metal freaks. This is King Diamond, and you're listening to ThreeRingRadio.com. With Shane, you better stay tuned.
Hi, this is Ben of Penn and Teller. You're listening to Three Ring Radio, but I've been known to lie.
You're all a bunch of fucking assholes. You know why? You don't have the guts to be what you want to be. You need people like me. You need people like me so you can point your fucking fingers and say, that's the bad guy. So, what'll I make you? Good? You're not good. You just know how to hide. How to lie. Me, I don't have that problem. Me, I always tell the truth. Even when I lie. The last time you're gonna see a bad guy like this again, let me tell you.
Some people say that I'm a bad guy. They may be right. They may be right. But it's not as if I don't try. I just fuck up, try as I might. But I can change, I can change. I can learn to keep my promises, I swear it. I'll open up my heart and I will share it. Any minute now I will be born again. Yes, I can change, I can change. I know I've been a dirty little bastard. I like to kill, I like to hate. Yes, I'm insane, but it's okay, cause I can change. It's not my fault that I'm so evil. It's society, society. You see, my parents were sometimes abusive, and it made a prick of me. But I can change, I can change.
What if you remain a sandy little butthole?
Hey, Satan, don't be such a twit. Mother Teresa won't have shit on me. Just watch me change. Here I go, I'm changing.
You're a member of the Church of Satan.
Yes, sir.
And he says he's written some books. What are the books?
In the Trench Coat Diaries. I got a lot of exclusive information from the kids that are in the Trench Coat Mafia.
You sound like a young guy. How old are you?
28.
Didn't you also write a cookbook with an 80-year-old serial killer?
Yes, yes.
Fascinating talking to you. Here's the man who has the Ed Gein headstone.
Right on. Hey, man, thanks for all the laughs.
Hey, thank you.
Take it easy.
All right, bye.
So we had you in last week, and it feels like just a couple of days ago, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Almost yesterday, actually. Yeah. Like 2 days ago, 3 days ago. Maybe.
Yeah. But you dropped off this great...
Let me grab the poster.
The great DVD, and how do I know it's great? Because I've seen it. H.H. Holmes, America's First Serial Killer. And that's hhholmesthefilm.com. And this is John Borowski.
Yeah, definitely. I'm glad you got a chance to actually watch the DVD. And, you know, what'd you think of it?
I loved it. And I know next week we're going to have Joe from Serial Killer Central, which is skcentral.com. And he's going to be in. But that's like next week. It's not next hour.
Okay. Right, no. We're yeah, I'll look forward to that one. Yeah. Right. Actually, am I on? Or I don't know.
Yeah, we're not going to... I swear, Joe is not in the other room waiting to come in. This is next week. But the DVD, well, we're going to talk about that more with Joe and Amy and stuff. AmyHorrorOfHorror.com. But we've left off talking about... I hate these headphones. We left off talking about Albert Fish, your
yes.
next project. And
yes.
you're traveling around looking for some funding for that right now.
Yeah, what I'm doing... in the month of July, I'll be going to New York to do some research, visit some of the locations like the Wisteria House where he's killed Grace Budd and interviewed
Albert Fish
Joe.
Is from New York?
Yeah.
Tell us about Albert Fish real quick, because you, at the end of last show, you had to really rush it, and it sounded like it just, I don't even know who he is. Well, I do, but.
Albert Fish was, if you ever had to look for an epitome of a kind old man or a grandfather that you'd want to watch your little children with, Albert Fish was the man. When they saw this man, when they actually found him, they said, wow, he looks just like my grandfather. He would offer candy and raisins to little kids, and that's kind of where this whole stranger danger thing actually started in America, was because of this guy, because after he did kill one of these little children, they found raisins in the kid's stomach, and that's how he would lure them, and then finally kill them and supposedly eat them.
John, I'm worried about you. Because Albert Fish is not the epitome of anyone I would leave my enemies' kids with. And that's just based on his photo. Okay, so I don't know who you leave your kids with, John. But well, maybe you don't have any kids, do you?
No. No,
that so you know of.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that I know of. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, again, and that's like the duality of a lot of these serial killers. You know, no one knew what was going on within Albert Fish's world until a letter arrived at the door of the Budd family. And this letter said, remember when I took your little girl to a party and she never came back? Well, here's how I killed her and ate her. So, this was 6 years after he had actually killed this little girl. So it's a fascinating crime story because of, again, the lack of forensics. But how they track this guy down and what he did, he would punish himself for killing these little children. So when he was finally caught, they took an x-ray of his pelvis and they actually found 29 sewing needles still stuck in his abdomen. Now, he was 64 years old, mind you.
And those shorted out the electric chair, right?
Well, you know, that's something to be, you know, talked about, because that's the lore. You know, there's a myth to many of these serial killers, like, oh, Ed Gein actually had his mother's body. No, he didn't. And same thing with Albert Fish. They said it shorted out the electric chair, but if you look back in history, no, there was, in actuality,
and
it never
happened.
And you
have looked back in history, huh?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So who are you going to interview? Who's left to interview from Fish? I mean, and I got to ask, okay, before I ask that, I've already asked it, so forget that. I remember Otis Toole. I remember a good recipe he had sent me for boy ass, you know, a barbecued boy ass and stuff. So I'm wondering, was Fish the one who wrapped it in bacon and said how sweet the young virgin's ass tasted?
Yes, exactly.
Oh.
He had some recipes du jour himself, yes.
So tell me more about what he did, his crimes. I want to hear about Albert Fish.
Well, yeah, he would.
And who are you going to go interview, and how are you going to? What's your point?
Yeah, not many people are left, but this is going to be. This isn't a documentary now; it's a feature film, so it's going to be like narrative film style.
This is a documentary.
Yeah, H.H. Holmes is a documentary, but done in a sort of feature film style.
Yeah, because it was confusing for me to watch. I didn't know. You know, I don't want to even talk about that. We're going to wait until next week, okay? But go ahead, tell me more about Fish.
Exactly. Yeah, so it's going to be a feature film, but I'm interviewing people to do research and also for the DVD extras. So when the DVD is released, we'll have interviews with people like Joe Coleman, who has actually done a painting portrait of Albert Fish.
A good one, too. I used to have a poster of that.
Yeah, that's sweet. Awesome. And Harold Schechter, who wrote a book on Albert Fish called Deranged. And
they all start with D's. Deranged and
depraved,
and then what's the Gein one? There's a Gein one that starts with D. Like, I think something deranged and depraved.
Oh,
probably.
Yeah. It is similar. It's
another
along those
D
lines,
one.
Yeah. But, yeah, so anyway, Albert Fish was killing little children in New York, mainly little boys, but he was killing children in New York, and then for penance, he would either beat himself with a homemade paddle, which he had nails, you know, a nail-studded paddle, and he would beat himself bloody with that, or he would have cat-o'-nine-tails. So that was his penance for killing these little children. And in his mind, again, I think we talked about that last time, where he kind of flipped religion upside down, and in his mind, it made him okay to kill these and eat these children.
Because with religion comes forgiveness.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is there anything that that you found out in your travels or your research that the... Well, not the common folk, but the common serial killer folk or true crime people like me wouldn't know?
Not at this point. You know, I'm still researching. So, see, what I have to do with the film is I have to put my own stamp on it. So what I do is I research everything that I could possibly get my hands on and say, okay, here's facts, but here's what I also believed happened. So, you know, some people would say he didn't rape these children. You know, there's never been evidence of that he just killed them or ate them. But, you know, those are things that I have to look into because I'm still writing the script.
Did you say there's no evidence of what?
Rape. Or any sort of, you know, there was, you know,
no
sometimes.
Pedophilia.
Exactly.
He was just doing it for food?
Well, no, there were semen found. They were definitely somewhat sexual crimes, but, you know, there was no sort of actual sexual interaction with these children. So, you know, and I think I mentioned it last time too, Chikolato, the
it's all about sex, though.
Yeah, right. Ooh. That Russian serial killer. You know, he had these urges and he, you know, killed these children. But Fish is just fascinating in that, you know, here's a nice, kind old man that no one would have a clue of walking down the street. You'd think, well, there's, you know, just a kind old man. But these things that he was doing, it was really a duality, a true duality, like Holmes and like many of these serial killers.
Interesting. So, do you have a favorite serial killer?
Probably, you know, Holmes. I keep going back to Holmes. You know,
he's
again,
good.
You know, he made crime his career.
Is it because he's an underdog?
No, because he was so attractive. Look at him. You know, the bowler, the mustache.
That's attractive to you?
No, I'm kidding.
You know what? He just doesn't look so... He doesn't... You know, they say how smart he is, and you'd say... I mean, they. You. Who am I saying they? You, yeah. And your DVD, you talked about how smart he was. Well, he just doesn't look
he
like...
He doesn't,
you know,
look
Ted,
too bright, does he?
Ted Bundy, he at least played the role. He could have ran for president or something. Yeah. You know what I mean? This guy just... I don't know, maybe it's the mustache. I'm always scared of dudes with mustaches. Or, for that matter, ladies with mustaches. But mustaches are scary. Facial hair is scary, to me. That's
you
me.
Know, and many people
As
say...
As a matter of fact, those are serial killer sideburns you got.
And I've got... Well, I don't have blue eyes, but I've got, like, green eyes. And you know, if you look at, like, Fish, Gein, and Holmes, just though, they all had blue eyes for some weird reason.
Are you trying to tell me the Aryan race isn't perfect?
Yes, they're all serial killers. But, no, the thing about Holmes was his persona and his personality. He knew how to win people over and how to smooth out some of these problems he would have with these contractors or business so that... You know, again, he never had a problem with it. He used the power of persuasion. He was a little guy. I mean, this guy was about 5'6". He was a little guy. But, again, his power of persuasion and what he could get people to do, it was just amazing what this man could do. So he was highly intelligent, but it was also the fact that he persuaded people.
I like Panzram a little better. And we talked about that a little bit on the phone. And I tried to get it in last week. And you know, John Holmes... That's your next film, right? After you do an H.H. Exactly. Holmes, then John H. Holmes.
Every time I type in a search for, you know, Holmes and John Borowski, of course, John Holmes comes up a lot. So
Long Dong serial killer. Yeah. Yeah. We were, you know, and Holmes you're going to talk to Amy about in a little bit. But I like Panzram, and you were talking off the air last time you were in about how you would do a Panzram movie, but it would just be nothing but violence and
it
brutal.
Would be.
So... I think Panzram is a better guy than this guy, no? I mean,
well, you know, it depends on what you're looking at in your serial killer. You know, Panzram was definitely someone who just, you know, I don't know how intelligent he was. Now, not that that would matter in the end, but Panzram was a guy that he got away with things, but he constantly traveled, which is some of these serial killer traits, too. They like to travel a lot, but especially Panzram.
Whoa.
And everywhere he went, you know, was a waves of violence or rape or death or, I mean... And I think he was kind of a part of that, you know, prison system too, like Eileen Wuornos. When they're younger, you know, they get thrown in prison and they get either, you know, raped or
become hardened.
You know, and right, and it's a constant cycle. They get out, they get in, they get out, they get in, and it gets worse and worse.
And Holmes, well, you know what? I'm going to play a song.
Cool.
And Amy's going to take over the reins here and talk to you about where you're coming from, because I come from the mind of a lunatic. I feel like I am a serial killer, and I'm that close to snapping, okay? And I'm just lucky I have someone like Amy to help me bury the bodies, or I'd be caught by now.
It's very important.
Yeah. So Amy's going to come in and talk to you about your real roots, which is horror.
Horror,
and,
yes.
And on your website, johnborowski.com, you'll see pictures of you as a young boy making... monster masks and stuff like that, and that's what you had talked about, I think, on the DVD extras, He talked about that's what you originally wanted to do was make
special effects, monsters. Yeah, right. I love all that.
So I'm going to play this great song by, well, you'll figure it out.
As immaturity may be a result of certain chemical imbalance. May the friggin' skate nicks flip the trigger on a sucker, squealing studs of pudness. They sing stuck in a rutten pig pod land. They share rigs with grave diggers. Worry about death when it's done, come and gone. You buy their records and they'll piss on your mama's best collectibles. They beat their rancid meat, expect you to pay the check. They ream the beef for bad backstage girls, redone in a new wave black. Up the butt, snuck, stuck, mucked up, sucked. I'd eat baboon bile before I'd bite on their juvenile penile pole projections they casually, smashingly refer to as my dick. Infected, rejected, afflicted, maledicted, boa constrictive. If immaturity is indeed a result of certain chemical imbalances, then these guys are on a permanent amico overload. Crawling through maggot breath, yeehaw, boys with latex toys. If buttholes were peep shows and the nigs are the window to the soul of this fucking ridiculous world. Anality's got nothing on these boyos except a signed royalty check, a forged signature, the toilet swipe, the mega acid smile, the glitch in the universal way, yeah. A real boss abortion to brag about at your next barbecue.
Thank my buddies for sticking the knife in my back. I'd like to thank my buddies for twisting the knife in my back. Trouble doesn't find me, I find it. People wanna make some. Don't take shit, I don't take shit! Patience is a virtue!
That's what we are known for song.
I'm only sorry when I am gone. The mouth is foamy from the vicious attack. The satisfaction of a rabid pack. Cockroaches determined to survive. Microwave me, wiping up alive. Screaming, mortal but invincible. Screaming, making life livable. Screaming, mortal but invincible. Screaming, we're making life livable. Take a look at my world. Dystopia with the blood I see all. I'd rather die on my feet than live on my knees. Suffer for me and suffer your disease. There's a sky in the eye of the beholder. We grow old while the seed grows lower. There's a sky in the eye of the beholder. We grow old while the seed grows older. There's a sky in the eye of the beholder. We grow old while the seed grows older. There's a sky in the eye of the beholder. We grow old while the seed grows older. There's a sky in the eye of the beholder. We grow old while the seed grows older. We'll be right back.
I've killed Shane, and we're going to barbecue him later.
I'm not dead yet!
Darn.
You will be.
I want a piece of his thigh.
Excellent. So I guess I'm Amy, the Horror Whore, and I'm taking over this damn radio show.
You have taken over.
Exactly. So, John, what do you have to say for yourself?
I'm happy to be here with you guys. I want to, you know, talk horror and... you know, I hear you love horror, and so I saw one of your Clive Barker items when I came over, and I was fascinated by that. So I know we have a lot to talk about because I grew up, of course, with Barker and King and Romero and Poe and Block, and you know, I'm sure you know all those names. So
excellent. So your movie, you know, Henry Holmes is also my favorite killer. So.
There you go.
I love that guy. You know, he's so prolific. How many people did he kill, exactly? Do they know? Do they have any clue?
Well, Harold Schechter, who did research, says 9 people he could say for certain. But, you know, could have been hundreds. He had a crematorium in his basement. He had vats of acid. He had a torture rack. He had quicklime pits in his basement. Mm. So he was all set to get rid of people. So in addition to making skeletons, he had all that in this basement. So some people say hundreds, and it could have been, because 20 million people visited the World's Fair, Chicago World's Fair at that time. So
I learned on your DVD.
Yeah, exactly.
So have you ever read this book, American Gothic, from Robert Bloch?
You know, I've thumbed through it. I know that it's based on Holmes, even though the name's changed. It's instead of like HHH, it's G. Gordon Gregg, I think, was his character. And I know Bloch had written another, like a true crime version of the Holmes story called, I think, just Dr. Holmes' Murder Castle or something like that.
So in that book, he suggested that that Holmes may have killed as many as like 300 people during the World's Fair. And he seemed to think that was a pretty accurate number.
It could be. You know, nowadays, some people may say, well, it may be more realistic to say maybe, you know, a dozen or two. But you just don't know. I mean, you know, Holmes's whole life was killing for profit. So the way I look at it is the more money he needed, the more, you know, he had to kill people over insurance scams, or, you know, his employees were all insured too, so he might kill one of them for money. You know, he was just an evil entrepreneur for that day. He really knew how to, you know, get away with things. And you know, that walk-in crematorium... He could have killed, you know, dozens right there.
Yeah. In the American Gothic, which is a fictionalized account of it, they said that one of the things he was doing was turning their bodies into potions to prescribe to people, so people were actually drinking bodily fluids from these dead bodies. Is there any truth to that, or was that just fictional?
I haven't heard of anything like that, but I wouldn't doubt it, because there were, supposedly Holmes was on the run when he came to Chicago from working as a druggist in another state, where he might have poisoned a little girl. So I'm sure he was dabbling in all types of poisons and drugs and medicine. And, you know, coming to Chicago, anything could have happened. He was selling tap water and gas from the city to people. But he was, of course, saying it was elixir, or, you know, spinning a certain name or title on it to fool people into actually believing, oh, this is elixir water. You know, he would use anything he could, so I wouldn't doubt that. I mean, see, that's the stuff I like, though, what you're talking about, because that's taking the maybe true crime or true story to another level, which is horror. But in Holmes' case, you don't really have to do that, but it's still, that's what I mean, that's what I was talking to Shane about. You know, which was making a film my own and looking at all the evidence and facts, but then saying, wow, it would be interesting if, you know, this may have happened. And I'm going to say, well, let's put that in the film. And that's what I'm doing with Fish now, to take it to, because I love horror so much. I want to take it to that horrific level on screen.
Interesting. So what I was really fascinated about on the DVD was that he had this guy living with him who was helping him, and you kind of alluded to the fact that he was in on some of these killings, but you never really say for certain. Do you think that this guy, he's just drunk trying to support his family. Do you think, was he involved in killing people?
Well, when I spoke with the author, his name is Everett, and he's the author of Scarlet Mansion, which is another novel. It's more of a narrative novel about Holmes, which is another great book to look into. And he was the first one where I had read that he implicated Peitzel and the janitor in the castle as potential, you know, right-hand men of H.H. Holmes, as far as maybe participating in the crimes as well. So I wrote to him and I said, well, how much of this, you know, is truth? He said, well, my book is about 95-98% truth, because he had actually taken it from the court transcripts and what people had actually said in true life. So, and in his book, he said that Holmes's second wife, Murda, he was saying that she kind of knew about some of these crimes, but she may not have said anything because Holmes set her up in a nice suburban house. You know, she didn't have to worry about money any day in her life. She was basically set up with one of their little kids there. So comes the time of the trial, what is she going to say? What did she say? Well, you know, he never hurt me or my child, so that's all I know about him. I don't know what he does in his business affairs. So, you know, some of these people may know at least a little bit about what he was doing. And I think Peitzel probably learned too much, and that's why he decided to get rid of him. And he wanted to wipe out his whole family.
Which he did a pretty good job of.
Yeah, he did. There were two or three survivors out of what, there was Peitzel and the three kids. So, you know, there was probably a family of six down the three, so...
Yeah, I didn't understand why he was driving around or traveling with these kids and keeping them all separate and yet keeping them alive for some period of time. It seemed kind of strange, and I thought in watching your film, probably part of his downfall was these three kids. He had children of his own?
He did. He had three wives, of course, at the same time, none of which knew of each other, but he had one children with the first two of his wife, one child each. So he had left his first wife and child in Gilmanton, New Hampshire. And then his second wife here in Chicago, he had another child with her. And, you know, there are a couple different ways to look at that. He may have been taking these children around the country to him to maintain a respectable atmosphere. So he could say, these are my children or my relatives. No one's going to think, well, this is a guy that has this building castle of horrors and is killing people. You know, and he was a very respectable, you know, a great personality. So not many people might question him when he has these kids with him. So he was smart in that regard, too. But I believe he was traveling, and you've probably seen the film where he went back and forth to states, like right one after another. He may have either been trying to lose detectives off his trail, or he may have just been looking for the right time and place to kill these kids.
Yeah, I wonder, because it seems so odd that he had these kids. I thought, does he have some kind of parental fixation or something? You know, I remember seeing some slasher movie a long time ago, and this guy, Skull, was this killer, and he would go to these women's houses and break in, and he's in this lady's house, and he hears a baby cry or something. He's like, you got kids, you know? So he would pretend to be the dad and then wipe everyone out. So I wondered if it was something like that, you know, some weird...
No, not that I know of. You know, it's, again, you know, there's a lot of hearsay when it comes to crimes of the past, because usually there isn't much information. Sure, you could go by the newspaper reports, but sometimes those are sensationalized as well. But, those are my two theories. And in the end, he did want to wipe out the entire family so that no one would be able to point a finger at him. Well, if there's none of them left, where's the evidence? And I believe after that he was going to take that insurance money and maybe go across country somewhere, or, you know, to another country like, you know, UK or who knows where.
It's weird. And he looks like such a nice, normal guy when you see photos of him.
Yeah.
You
know. Yeah, you know, it, at the time, no one knew anything. Even it was even surprising, but Chicago didn't know much of what was going on at the time either in his building. So, but then again, it was almost, it was pretty much a different age back then. So,
yeah, I was fascinated. We watched the outtakes too, and the one woman from the, I guess, crime lab,
the forensics, yeah, Illinois forensics,
and she said the start of like these crime labs was after the St. Valentine's Day massacre.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, that's, it's pretty cool that a lot of the Holmes film is somewhat Chicago-based because it was the Illinois Crime Lab and the profiler Tom Cronin. He used to be a Chicago Police Department commander. So it's, you know, and I use many locations like the Comeback Inn restaurant in Melrose Park. That's where we shot the torture dungeon scenes with all the brick walls looking like a castle. So
that was awesome.
Yeah.
So we were talking the other day about how these people, like Holmes or, you know, Gacy, any of these people, they're way scarier than the, you know, Dracula or Frankenstein or anything that, you know, like actual horror monsters, you know. I mean, because you can't see that they're so evil. You see Frankenstein, you think, oh, I could be in trouble with this guy, you know. What do you think about that? Like, people being so evil.
Well, you know, even some of those stories, Dracula was, in the end, based on a true story, Vlad the Impaler. So I just look at what I'm doing as an extension, maybe, of some of those. Because even if you look at Frankenstein, what's the basis of that? Grave digging, which was going on. You know, lycanthropy was, you know, the wolfman or the werewolf. So, you know, I believe that why are filmmakers now making movies on these serial killers is because they're kind of like our modern horror icons, and they've actually lived within our time period. You know, we're not talking about, you know, Vlad the Impaler. We're talking about Dahmer, who was, you know, living, what, 10, 14 years ago or when he was found. So I think that even makes it even scarier to know that, wow, this was literally right around the corner. This just happened not too long ago. So I think it's stuff like that, and again, like I said, it's a true life aspect, plus it's up to filmmakers to really bring out that horrific aspect of it. And that's what I like to do. That's why I shot, you know, the dungeon scenes in the Holmes film in this brick, almost like a castle dungeon. And that was inspired by those other horror films like Dracula and Frankenstein. So that was my little nod to that. But, you know, real-life horrors, I believe, are much scarier. I've always grown up watching monster movies. I've loved them. But then I, you know, also like the slasher films and a lot of the gore films, too. So.
Yeah, it's weird. You know who Morgan Fairchild is?
Yeah.
I read in an interview with her that she lived in New York when she was 17 because she married some music promoter and moved there. And she was walking down the street one day, and these guys kidnapped her, and they were going to kill her. And she's driving around with these guys in this car, and, you know, and they're telling her they're going to torture her, they're going to rape her, they're going to kill her. And she's like, oh, my God, what do I do? So she starts making jokes and talking to them. And pretty soon they were like, oh, you know what? You're pretty funny. We're not going to kill you. And they let her go. And I thought, imagine, you know, that is... I mean, I guess that's like our modern horror, you know, being picked up off the street. You know, kids are kidnapped all the time and killed. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, it's...
Well, that's what I think is interesting, you know, and a lot of people ask me, well, why are you doing these movies on these serial killers, or why is it horror, blah, blah, blah. And I always use a quote from Ed Gorey, the artist, and someone asked him the same question. He said, well, I guess I'm just interested in real life. Open your newspaper. Turn on the TV. I mean, you open your newspaper now, it's a child strangled. It's, you know, children, you know, drowned in lake by their mother. Or, I mean, these are awful, awful stories. But obviously people are interested. Otherwise, they wouldn't be in our daily newspapers. So, again, you're right. And these kidnappings and these, you know, even now, children killing other children. Within the last 2 or 3 months, I think I've seen cases. There was a little girl in Japan that slit another girl's throat. I mean, we're talking 10, 13 years old here. And then another case where a boy lured another boy into a bathroom and killed him in the bathroom, too. I mean, again, these are like middle school kids. So there's obviously something else at work in this world that's making kids and people do this. And what is it, you know?
You know, I don't know. I've come up with this weird theory about the problems with, like, our, you know, we have this weird thing about rape and sexuality in this country because we're so uptight sexually. And the only time you really see sex on in movies and TV is horror movies. And so I think for these kids growing up, they're seeing... The only time they're seeing boobs on TV is when they're seeing someone get slashed to death, and I think that there's got to be some correlation between that.
No, that you can't say that because then they'll say when kids are killed, they're gonna blame it on me for my Albert Fish movie. But you know, it's really tough. I have no idea. I do agree. I think Shane and we talked about suppression and suppressing some of the, you know, who you really are, and you know, some of these, you know, primal instincts that we grew up with just being, you know, again, it's just being suppressed and pushed down. You can't talk about sex. You can't think about it. You know, when I was a kid, you know, my eyes would be shielded from any time there was a naked part on screen. But, you know, I'm against censorship. And, of course, if I had children, I would be very careful. I'm not going to sit them down and watch one of these guinea pig movies where they, you know, supposedly torture these people on screen. And it looks like it's really happening, I would know my limits. But if it's a fantasy film or even a horror that doesn't really push the boundaries too much, I would let them watch it and make up their own mind, but explain to them, okay, here's what you're watching.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you're censoring things, well, of course, you know, some of these children might want to see what it's really like, and that's when they may start getting into killing or raping or whatever it is. I believe in full exposure.
Yeah, and I'm not saying less slasher movies and less boobs. I'm saying more boobs on all TV shows and stuff like that. And then I think it'll even everything out.
I agree. You know, it's like we've got this, you know, hang-up about the human body, but it's, you know, the most beautiful thing in the world. And it's, I mean, come on, let's just get over that fixation on that. I mean, sure, some of the gore, you know, might go overboard, but not for gore fans. But again, if you're showing it on TV... You know, I mean, and children have frail minds, so.
Well, I have to say, when my niece was 2 years old, she couldn't go to sleep at night unless she watched Nightbreed.
Oh, I love Nightbreed.
Every single night. She had to watch Nightbreed or she wouldn't be able to fall asleep.
That's awesome. Now, see, that would be me as a kid. I love that stuff. I was a kid and I absolutely loved horror films. You know, I, like I said, again, my mom wouldn't take me to see, you know, diehard slasher films, but when I was a kid, she would take me to see monster movies and action films, and I love that stuff. I couldn't wait. I mean, when my sister described Alien to me and how this thing burst out of this guy's stomach, imagine at that time, I mean, I was just so excited. Now, how many little kids would want to go to see a film where something bursts out of a guy's stomach? But I thought, wow, that's really cool, and it's scary, and I just love scary and creepy things, and I think it's healthy for all ages. It's just like a roller coaster, right?
I agree. So what was the first movie that you saw that really scared you when you were a kid?
Oh, I don't know. I think Shane asked me that, too. You know, I'm not sure. I never really got, you know, like nightmares or really scared from movies like that. I just enjoy them. I saw them more as enjoyment rather than scaring me. I wanted to push the envelope. You know, I think one of the earliest movies I saw was Jaws because I remember when it, of course, when he pops out of the water the first time, my legs came up in the movie theater. I thought it was, you know, I thought it was right below me. I pulled him up. So, you know, stuff like that. You know, I just love horror in general, period. You know, like I said, I just love that feeling of more creepiness than shocks. That's me. That's why I like Psycho. It's, you know, there's, I think, two shocking periods in the whole film when the two people get killed. But other than that, it's suspense and creepiness. I love atmosphere. And that's why I love those old Universal horror films, because you've got the fog and the moonlight, and you know, some of that is cliche now, but if it's done the right way, there's still a mood and an atmosphere that you create for the audience.
That was great in your film with the smoke, you know, coming up, and it was all black and white.
Yeah.
All this recreation, so they made it look like an old Jack the Ripper movie. Mm-hmm. Or something like that.
Cool, thanks.
So
yeah,
that made it,
yeah,
interesting.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to do. I really wanted to, again, make it like you were there, almost like time period, like these shots, the reenactments that I filmed, what you're watching, are almost like footage taken from that time period. So I wanted to pull people in so much that they forgot they're watching a film.
So in the future, you're working on a Fish movie now. Is that a documentary as well?
No, that's going to be a feature film.
Ah, so yeah. Now you want to start making like films?
Yeah, because that's actually what I've wanted to do all along. Because when I was in high school, I would,
do special makeup. I would do masks and corpse heads, and we would film, you know, these short films in my backyard on 8mm. So that's where I've always wanted to go to, and then when I went to college, I took filmmaking. But the reason I started with Holmes as a documentary is because of the budget. You know, doing that as a feature narrative film, you know, it could be millions, tens of millions of dollars. So that's why I chose to do it as a documentary, because it was a lower budget and I could get some exposure from it. So that was my reasoning behind that. So the attention that Holmes has gotten me will hopefully bring me the Fish Project, or at least financing for it. So I'm talking to some people about that now.
Hmm. So what's your top favorite horror movies?
Psycho is number one. I don't know about top. I do love Nightbreed a lot. You know, my favorite directors are like Cronenberg. I love The Brood. That's one of my favorites of his of all time. Romero's great. Dawn of the Dead is my and Creepshow, of course. Creepshow would have to be in my top 10 horror. I saw that so many times at the theater when it came out. I know every line of it. I've actually got a picture of me when I graduated from grade school. I used all my money to buy the VHS of Creepshow. It was like $90 at the time. But I have a picture of me holding Creepshow. That's how much I loved it. I'd watch it like every day. So Creepshow's huge on my list. You know, again, just great films by great directors. Just love horror in general.
Do you read a lot of horror?
You know, not as much as I'd like to. I love to read horror. Definitely love, like I said, Clive Barker's works. Stephen King is a staple. Poppy Z. Bright, actually love her exquisite corpse story. Love to make a film of that in the near future. I've talked to her about that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's pretty neat. About two serial killers. I don't know if you know about it, but one is from... They're like the best serial killers in the world. One is from the UK and one is here in America, and they wind up meeting. And it's like, well, they fall in love. So that's a pretty interesting story. It's definitely out there, but it's pretty cool.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. So I've noticed it seems like you used to be able to go into a bookstore and there's a whole horror section where you can, you know, get just about anything, and now bookstores don't have horror sections anymore. What do you think has happened?
Well, that's I think that's part of the corporate commercialism that's taking over our country. You know, if you look at everything from Lowe's theaters to Blockbuster Video to these Borders bookstores and Barnes & Nobles, well, it's almost like a cleansing thing. They're almost trying to make everything family safe, you know, child-oriented or family-friendly. Blockbuster, of course, now rents videos, and they advocate a DVD player that censors films. So you could either get movies from Blockbuster or get a DVD player without all the bad parts cut out. So Pulp Fiction would be 5 minutes, basically. You know, or, you know, when you look at these Lowe's theaters, I remember when I was a kid, I would go to these little dive theaters to see Hills Have Eyes and all these weird B-movies that you wouldn't see anywhere else. Now, where are you going to see stuff like that? Even Bubba Hotep, this underground film that just came out recently, it played at one theater in Chicago. You know, because again, it's not a family film. It's not. It doesn't fit a cookie cutter mainstream mentality. And it's almost like these corporations want to turn people into zombies by making everything clean, push everything bad under the carpet, or, you know, and it's unfortunate that horror is looked down that way. But it's always been looked at almost that way. You know, horror is always, you know, even in art, it's horror is usually the springboard for many of these filmmakers like Sam Raimi, Peter Jackson. They start out doing horror films, but at the time, are they really recognized? Well, yeah, within their, you know, their cult circles and horror fans, but outside of that, you tell people you're a horror filmmaker, you know, I don't know how seriously they truly take you, unless they're fans, you know. It's unfortunate.
It is, and it's really frustrating for horror fans. Like, our closest video store now is a Blockbuster Video, and they edit their movies. They edit them, and they don't even tell you that they've edited them. Mm-hmm. And we've rented movies from there, and all of a sudden, there's like, something has happened, but you don't know what happened. Right. You just know something happened, and they cut it out.
Exactly.
And that just seems so, so bizarre. I mean, what does he think they're trying to protect us from?
The evils of the world. I don't know. Again, it's like when I was a kid, when my eyes would be shielded, if there was a nudity scene on screen, that's what they're trying to do to these generations that are coming up. But again, it's, you know, it's about full access. I don't agree with that. It's a tough call. Like I say, it's up to the parents to teach these kids, you know, and to explain things. But then again, you have to. And, you know, what about creating an NC-17 rating? And they don't even use it. I'm against the whole rating system, of course, but how many movies are ever released with that? I think, you know, a handful might have ever been released with that rating.
In general, it's for sex, not violence anyway.
Yeah, of course. Oh, right. You know, you could have the most violent movie in the world. I mean, look at Amelie. I think they give that an R rating because she swears, or they... Oh, no, it was the part when they talk about sex. She wonders how many people are having sex right now, and they just cut to these quick shots. No nudity, really, not even, you know, at least frontal. But just because they're, you know, people simulating sex acts, it gets an R rating. But it's, you know, one of the most cleanest movies and most kindest movies in the world.
Yeah, I've noticed a disturbing trend in Hollywood where they're making all these horror movies, like even Texas Chainsaw Massacre they remade, and they're putting a PG-13 on it. And so we're watching this Texas Chainsaw Massacre and this girl's, you know, running in this Dago tee or whatever they're calling them now, wife beaters, which, you know, don't even get me started on that. And she's running and it's raining and she must have on the most padded bra on earth because you see absolutely nothing. And it's like, what is the point of remaking these movies or making horror movies if they're going to be PG-13?
Well, right. It's just, you know, they're now Hollywood is just going through remakes, retreads, and rehashes. It's, why would you even touch some of these original Amityville Horror? They're remaking that. Just, you know, they're remaking it because people are familiar with the name. And the same thing with Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And they remake them. They use models and, you know, everyone's wearing the perfect clothes or the trendy clothes. And it's like, you know, it's not really about that. It's, in the end, it's about what's best for the film. And you don't have to have models in all your films. That was what was so great about a lot of those movies from the 70s. They just looked like they were people pulled off the street.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'd like to have in my films. But, yeah, you know, I totally agree.
I just don't understand that. It seems so pointless.
Yeah, it is. It's unnecessary because you have people like me, and I know there are, for a fact, there are many, many other filmmakers out there that have original ideas that they could bring to screen on low budgets. But, you know, Hollywood is another thing. And that's why, of course, when I first started out in this industry, I always, Hollywood, Hollywood, Hollywood. But in the end, it's like, you know, I realized there is an independent filmmaking community, and that's what I want to be part of. And that's why I'm the back of my DVD, it's 100% independent made. It's, you know, I wanted to do it the way I did. I had a vision. I know I have talent, so I put it together. And it's like, why should I wait for a producer to stand in back of me and tell me what to do? And, you know, it's like, they don't even, half the time, they don't even know what they're doing. I've encountered so many people making this film, and they say, wow, John, you know so much more than even producers we've worked with. And these are for big companies, because they just tell them, oh, here, throw something together. You know, whereas I work with them and tell them, explain to them what I want, what kind of feeling I want from either the music or the sounds, and here's what I'm trying to convey. But they'll say, a producer would come in and say, oh, just make it sound good. You know, and that's what's going on, though. It's this cookie-cutter thing. It's being passed from person to person. They need a filmmaker in there to really mold that film and put their stamp on it, like a Hitchcock, like an auteur.
Mm. Yeah, so if you were going to kill someone, how would you do it?
Good question. I don't know if I'd strangle. That's a little too hands-on. Maybe poisoning or something like that.
To watch them suffer?
Oh, yeah, or so that they wouldn't feel that much pain. You know, they would just hopefully go.
Poisoning? Is it suffering?
Clean. I don't know. Some kind of poisoning that they die in their sleep. I don't know.
You ever think about it? You ever drive down the street and think, I could just pick up one of these people and kill them and no one would know?
No, actually no. But, you know, when I make my films, that plays a crucial part in it. Or if I'm writing scripts, how is this person going to do that? And how do they do that? Because each killer usually has their own signature style. See, Holmes wasn't hands-on. You know, you might have seen some of that in a documentary. You'd either gas them, or many times he gassed them. Or there were some times he may have strangled some people, but it was really, you know, it wasn't too much. He liked to do his work when they were dead. So he liked to either make skeletons out of them or do whatever he wanted to do with them after the fact. But I think it's interesting how, and the theories behind how some of these killers, some may use guns like Berkowitz, or some may like to use a knife. It's just, it's interesting because it shows you how they feel about other people and how mm-hmm. they relate to them. Are they really hands-on, or do they really want to be, you know, standoffish about, you know, their murder tactics?
Hmm. I think I'd go with bludgeoning. I think that's the way to go.
Really?
You know?
Yeah, that's messy. You know, and that's what I thought was interesting. I love watching Hitchcock's film, and I remember Strangers on a Train. They asked that question, how would you kill someone? And every time someone mentioned, oh, stabbing, you know, bludgeoning, it's too messy. Strangling's the easiest way to go. Simple, clean, you walk away.
But that doesn't seem so easy. I mean, that takes a long time to strangle someone.
And you have to be pretty strong, too.
Yeah, I mean...
Yeah, but look at Dennis Nilsson. I don't know if you're familiar with his... Well, he was the UK version of Jeffrey Dahmer. He would get all these guys to come back to his apartment, and he would strangle them. And, you know, here was a guy with another guy. He didn't have a problem strangling them at all. And to make sure they were dead, he would dip their heads in a bucket of water to drown them.
Well, I guess that's certainty.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I'd want to get messy, though, if I'm killing someone, you know? I mean, I've seen people get killed, you know, murdered before.
You have?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have a story about it on my website.
Oh, wow, cool. I have to check that one out.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I thought was always interesting, because I always wonder if there are people out there that would like to see something like that. And, you know, there's probably a lot of that happens on webcams. Actually, I think that I heard something like that. Someone killed someone. Or that one guy in Germany, that cannibal recently. Mm. He videotaped it, the whole way he cut and ate the guy up.
Yeah, because he wanted to prove that it was consensual. So
yes.
He had the victim. You know, it's funny. Everybody was talking about, oh, this cannibal. And Shane and I were talking about it. And I was like, the cannibal isn't the interesting one. It's the guy who wants to be eaten.
Yes.
He's leaving his job, packing up a suitcase, and taking a train to a guy's house to hang out and be eaten. And then he's eating his own penis before he's killed.
Exactly.
You know, there's the fascinating story.
Yeah, you know, as a society, we, you know, I feel, yes, we are becoming, you know, more intelligent and somewhat more stable, but at the same time, we're not. Because if you see, we're going on two roads. We're becoming, you know, definitely a better society, but there's another road that I also heard of another case. I think it was in the UK that this kid, through a chat line, fooled another kid into believing this whole story about Secret Service, and he wanted this other kid to kill him. I think they were teenagers. And this kid did stab him a couple times, so he made up this whole story. I mean, it's just, these things are occurring all around the world, especially with younger people. And then, to me, that's frightening. You know, how, if we can't even trust kids now we have to be worried about literally little kids killing us. It's like, geez.
Well, let's face it, when you're a kid, you think you're invincible. You don't understand the finality of death.
Yeah.
You know, you don't understand when someone dies, they're not going to come back at some point. You're not going to see them on the street. And I think it takes a long time for people to understand that.
Yeah. Who knows? Village of the Damned may come true. I still haven't seen that film, but not the original, the black and white one, where all the kids, I guess, are killing people or something. I know Carpenter did a remake.
Yeah, it just seems, especially young people, they don't understand, because they'll go out and shoot each other or, you know, put themselves in really dangerous situations because they don't understand. As a teenager, I put myself in horribly dangerous situations.
Yeah.
You know, I hung around with people that killed. You know, I went out drinking with guys when they had a body in their trunk, you know, and they made jokes about it. And I never feared for my safety, thinking, geez, could I be a body in a trunk?
Oh,
I thought, oh, these guys are nice guys. They just do something interesting for a living, you know?
Until you know too much. Yeah, you were lucky. You know?
Yeah, and then I think about it. Now I think, was I nuts? You know, I had these people in my home, you know, went out with them. No one knew where I was or who I was with. I could have just turned up missing. It's weird. I think the further... But I think what you're saying is interesting. I think the further we get away from our primal instincts and our animal, the more that animal becomes a compulsion for us.
Exactly. Yeah. Because, like I said, look what's going on with these kids. And because of all this suppression, because we're just being fed family films and edited films and everything's trying to be cleansed, some of these people may need to see that type of thing instead of enacting it out on their own. Because I heard in a lot of these Japanese or Hong Kong films, people over there say they love to watch that stuff, and they're super violent, they're over violent. Well, why? Because they need that. They need that as a release, mm-hmm. rather than doing it themselves. Now, sure, they may not all kill on their own, but they need to see the ultra-violent films.
Yeah, I think it's like it fills some, just like eating chocolate or something. You just need it sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. Know? And that's why, you know, I don't sit and watch gore films and horror films every second of every day. I mean, I wish I could, but, you know, I watch all different types of films. But to watch those films, yeah, there is, I don't know if you've ever heard of In a Glass Cage.
No.
Oh, that's a great film, and it's all about this ex-Nazi who was also a child killer, and he attempts to kill himself, but he's alive in one of those, what do you call it? It's the breathing, it's like you're encased, all you can move is your head. It's, you know, one of those, well, they say it's a glass cage, but I forgot what the medical term is. It keeps someone alive, but it's like a machine. So anyway, he's stuck in this machine, and a younger guy comes over and says, well, I'll help take care of him if you need a nurse. Well, this younger guy knows about his past. So this younger guy starts bringing little kids and killing them in front of him, thinking that he'll get off on it. But just that movie alone, I couldn't even take my eyes off of the screen because it was just so fascinating seeing something that I don't see it every day in movies.
What's the name of this movie?
In a Glass Cage. It's phenomenal. I mean, I didn't even blink during the whole movie, I bet. My eyes were probably pretty dry, but it's a spooky movie. It really is. It's just the fact that this guy's in this machine, and here's this guy enacting out parts from his diary, from this killer's diary. It's frightening. And you know, seeing these kids, they show it graphically, but of course it's filmmaking style, so you may see some cutaways to a needle going into a kid's neck or whatever, but it's something that you wouldn't see at Blockbuster or you wouldn't see every day. And those are the things that I'm looking for now because I've seen so much already.
Yeah, you know, it's weird with fewer and fewer mom and pop video stores and stuff like that. So many movies are being forgotten and left behind. Not even horror movies, just good movies. All of a sudden, there's movies I'm looking for. I'll walk through the video store. I can't find them. They don't exist anymore as far as Blockbuster or Walmart or Best Buy is concerned.
Yeah, that's why Netflix, you know, and some of these places are doing pretty well because they have a better selection.
Yeah, I got to get on that Netflix.
Because, you know, I mean, Blockbuster, every time they get new movies in, they take their old ones, unless they're, of course, on the AFI Top 100 or whatever, something like that, and they leave them. But they take their old ones and they sell them. So it's like they'll never really have hard-to-find old movies that you're looking for. It's frightening.
And that's a real shame, especially because so few good movies get made, period. You know, you can only see so many Men in Black or whatever. You know?
Yeah. Well, that's why, you know, and I'm sure your listeners like underground and cult and independent films and, you know, look for those. And that's what I do. I think I go to the actual cinema like one or two times a year because everything else I either rent from Netflix or from, in Chicago, there's a great store, Facets. They have a lot of hard-to-find titles. I found an old silent movie there, Man Who Laughs, which is a great Victor Hugo book, but they deformed this guy made his face like a laugh. You always see it in, like, the old famous monsters. You know, it's a guy that has this enormous smile. And, you know, just hard-to-find stuff, and that's what I look for.